Hi, welcome back to the Hopeless Romantic Podcast. I'm Austin Chant.
I'm Amanda Jean.
And this is our show. Today we are doing an intro episode for new authors. This is our So You Want to Write a Queer Romance Novel episode. Part one of probably two.
We hope to.
Could be more in the future. So for this episode, we're going to cover everything you need to know before submitting your book. And our next episode will be everything you need to know to start submitting your book. So today is going to cover everything from some of the ins and outs of what queer romance is, some of the genre conventions, and some of the publishers that you might consider working with, and the writing process, beta readers, that kind of thing. And then in our next episode, we'll be talking about submitting your book, working with editors, what to do after your book is published.
Contracts,
lots of legal stuff, money, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, this is the stuff that you're just going to need to know to get your foot in the door. And everything else is the micro level examination of the paperwork.
Yes. And the fun stuff like blog tours and things like that.
I mean, fun by a certain definition.
Hey, some of us enjoy schmoozing.
So I think the best place to start is to give people an overview of what queer romance is. Because when you hear queer romance, it doesn't come with its own definition. A lot of people are new to it and maybe don't understand where it's come from, its influences. And as someone who grew up reading traditional romance, or I guess heterosexual romance, I knew immediately when I started reading queer romance that it was born of the sort of het successor. It is not wholly shaped by traditional romance. It has its own, you know, separate legacy, but one of the contributing factors is het romance. And what is het romance? It's Harlequins, it's Mills and Boone. It's a lot of really great forward-thinking digital-first or digital-only publishers that exist in the market now. But I think your average person, when they hear the phrase romance novel, is going to picture one of those really wonderful, like, Fabio-esque sweeping embrace covers.
Yes.
Her darkest fantasy, a man in a kilt. And that's the genre that I think has gotten a bad rap, honestly. Romance is seen as trashy, it's seen as beach read, seen as a lesser genre. And that's a bummer, because while romance does have its pitfalls and has had a history of some pretty gross misogyny and every genre has its pitfalls. And Austin, you were saying, while romance does get hit for being trashier or having problematic material, so does sci-fi.
Yeah, pretty much any genre you look at. I mean, romance really uniquely gets a rap for being, you know, anti-woman, which is funny because it is the only genre that is primarily by and for women.
And catering to women.
And nobody looks at fantasy and says, wow, fantasy is misogynist garbage, because chances are if you pick like a random fantasy book, your odds of getting something sexist are reasonably high, because that's literally all fiction. Romance really uniquely gets a bad rap. And the reason we wanted to start with that is because if you want to write romance, you have to respect romance. You can't come into this saying, like, I'm going to write queer romance and it's going to be better than romance, which sucks inherently, because queer romance takes a lot from traditional romance. It takes structure. We're going to talk about romance structure. It takes tropes. It takes characterization shorthand. It takes a lot from romance. So know that it's very possible that the exposure you've had to romance has been a little bit colored by, shall we say, a bias.
A pretty big bias, yeah. And maybe it hasn't been. Maybe you're a person who's read a lot of more modern, traditional romance. I say modern because, again, the industry has had its growing pains. I loved traditional romance when I was growing up. There was nothing that sort of tickled my fancy more than the plot twists and turns and the knowing that no matter how intense or dark or misunderstood things were, it would end happily was so great. It was an adrenaline rush with each book. But I was aware, even when I was a young teen and even younger than that, that things were a little racist and misogynistic, and occasionally there was glorified depictions of rape that were not called rape in the story itself. And I am happy to say that the genre has rehauled itself to be less loose with consents and less rife with misogyny. It's still there, but there are definitely still elements in books that are problems. No genre is free of this, by the way. Sci-fi is still super racist in some corners. Publishing is still really white, so...
I would say romance is at least a genre where we're having a lot of those conversations and where the issue has kind of been put at the forefront. Like, there are a lot more conversations about consent in romance that I have seen than, for example, in Westerns or in rather non-romance Westerns or non-romance fantasy. So yeah, I would say if you're already a romance reader, great. If you're not already a romance reader, you probably should be.
At least know what you're getting into. You should read one or two. You should look for something that has been published recently.
Yeah.
Although I would say the best thing to do, and I know not everyone's going to want to commit to this, but is to like pick up something that was published before 1998 and pick up something that was published recently by an ebook, you know, a digital heavy publisher. Even Harlequin's really got a focus on ebooks now too, because that's the way things have gone over the last 10 years. But pick them up and compare them and look at the corseted historical published by Harlequin back in the day, and then look at something either historical now or contemporary now and see how it's changed, because it definitely has. And hopefully you would have a fun time. At the core of these books, they're meant to be entertaining. They're meant to be engaging. They're meant to keep you on the edge of your seat. You're meant to be like, oh, I hope these idiots get together and, you know, fall in love, because that's what romance is. We're all arrowed in on the fun ride towards the happy ending. And so if you can do that, if you've never picked one up before, if you can go and do that, you'll have a much better understanding of what it is we've inherited as queer readers or readers of queer romance now. Because again, traditional romance isn't the only thing that the genre has drawn inspiration from, but to at least know, oh, okay, so the trope of misunderstandings is going to be big in both traditional romance and in queer romance.
Queer romance also has other influences, not just traditional romance. So queer romance also comes from queer fiction, and it also comes from fandom. There's a lot of authors come over from writing fan fiction, or who have started there, or who are at least very familiar with it. They didn't necessarily start there.
A lot of slash
writers and readers. And so a lot of tropes are also come from that space. A lot of character types. I would argue that the shifter genre in romance has a huge influence from fandom, just enormous. And that's only one area. There's lots of areas where you can see fandom's influence. And then, of course, the legacy of queer literature and queer romantic literature also has a heavy influence on queer romance.
And I think it's important to talk about the difference between literature with romance in it and queer romance. And that's why it was so important to me to mention, like, we take so much of our legacy from het romance with its happy endings, with its, you know, corsets and overblown scenarios and its diabolical villains and its men in kilts. It's very extreme situations, because literature that has romance in it is not a romance novel. It has a romance in it. It may end happily. It may not. It may actually be, you know, a first person stream of consciousness narrative detailing the inner journey of its main character. And it also might have a romance in it. It might have some steamy scenes in it to boot. That doesn't make it a romance novel. So if you're someone who wants to write queer fiction that has a love story in it or that has some sex in it, queer romance may not be the genre for you. Queer romance is pretty specific to romance convention.
Yeah. But with that said, it also, you might find more flexibility in what romance means than you might think. So romance fiction does have a certain amount of structure, and it does have a certain amount of narratives that are traditionally considered part of that. But that's way more flexible than you would think.
Yeah, I don't want to make it seem like you have to write a Harlequin-style romance to be considered legitimate. That's not true at all. There are, in fact, a lot of publishers who are moving into more traditional literary fiction. So you can find a home. It's just a matter of whether or not you're going to market something as queer romance versus queer literature.
As an example of something that you might not realize is encompassed in romance, the Captive Prince series by C.S. Picat is considered romance. It is a very intense, very violent fantasy trilogy, and it doesn't exactly follow the traditional romance structure, but if you look at it through the lens of romance, you will see that the beats are absolutely there. They're sort of placed differently because it's a trilogy and because it was originally published as a serial, but that is an example. That is a romance story, and it hits those beats.
It has the added benefit of having hit a lot of bestseller lists and reached a lot of market saturation. So that's a great example of something that doesn't necessarily tick all of the buttons, but still fits within the genre and managed to do a lot of business and gain a lot of fans along the way. It has a big readership, Austin included. I watched him recently spiral down the hill. The hill.
I won't go off on the I love Captive Prince tangent, but I love Captive Prince.
You do. This is a great time to talk about the fact that queer romance is an umbrella term for a bunch of different identities that are represented within it, and how different publishers will publish stories that focus on different letters of the LGBTQIA acronym. It is not a surprise to many people that stories about gay men with gay men sell a lot. They are very much highlighted. And there is, as an aside, a little bit of division between authors who write male-male romance or MM romance and people who would write gay romance or gay fiction with romance in it. MM has often been seen as something, MM romance has been seen as something that is, it's been miscategorized as being written for women by women. Austin and I have found that that's actually not the case. There are plenty of straight women in this genre because people love to read what they love to read, but to boil it down to male-male romance is written by straight women for straight women is completely reductive and not true. There are so many queer people who read and enjoy male-male romance that are not straight and are not women.
Yeah, I think the specific charge that gets leveled at it is that it is by cisgender heterosexual women for cisgender heterosexual women and does not represent and is not welcoming to anyone else. And while certainly it's not perfect and there are issues there, like the vast, vast majority of authors and readers I know are not.
Not that.
There are tons and tons of queer women. I know tons and tons of trans folks and gay men and bi men.
We're all here. We're all under the umbrella. We all, at some point, read and enjoy MM. Maybe not all, but many people enjoy and read MM. And I also don't want to malign straight women, cisgender straight women who read or write MM, because there are plenty of them. They are, for the most part, extremely lovely people, and they enrich the genre. And so I just don't want to fall into the trap of being misogynistic, because the romance industry already has enough of that. It's like anytime there's a demographic that's perceived as slanting feminine, it gets a little bit dumped on, and I don't want to do that either.
Yeah, I think there are conversations that have been going on in the industry that are really important about making sure that representation of queer folks is empowering and good for queer folks and is not for the enjoyment of primarily cis straight people. And I also don't want to diminish that. But one of the things that I come from, as somebody who comes from fandom, that is also a space that is primarily perceived as being by and for cisgender straight women. And actual surveys that have found the demographics have just found that that's not true. And I suspect that that is also not necessarily true of queer romance. The primary consumers and writers of fandom are queer women, and straight women are not the majority in that space. So yeah, it's just something to be aware of, is that there is a perception that MM is separate from real gay literature, and that has not been my experience. That said, there are certainly conversations about, I don't know.
No, it's important to not knock MM as being somehow less valid, but it is also important to make sure that people keep a healthy awareness of the fact that sometimes, as in any genre, as in any, you know, niche of publishing, things can happen. And it's, and one of the things we've talked about on the podcast before is making sure if you are not writing your own experience, then you don't write a book that attempts to tell that experience. If I were to write trans romance, I wouldn't want to write the book about the trans experience. I would not centralize their transness. I would write a trans romance. Like, I would write a romance with trans characters in it. It wouldn't be me trying to co-opt some experience that isn't mine and capitalizing on it. And I think that's the important thing to keep in mind with, you know, the rap that MM romance gets is that, look, you can write what you want to. You just have to be aware that you can't co-opt someone else's experience, and you'll probably get it wrong if you try.
Oh, also, side note, this came up that not all listeners of our podcast necessarily know what the word cisgender means, and we've used it so much in previous episodes that that's a shame. So, quick definition. If you're just joining us for this episode, cisgender means... it refers to a person who identifies with the gender they were assigned at birth, which is to say somebody who is not transgender. And it is used in conversation so that we can avoid ever saying something like trans people and normal people. Never say that.
Never say that.
Yes, that's what that means. So with all this talk about like what is romance and you have to respect what romance is, what is romance? We want to talk a little bit about the general structure and conventions of a romance novel. First off, romance novels almost exclusively have happy endings. They either have a happily ever after, or HEA, or an happily for now, HFN. Happily ever after means like they have a white picket fence in the end and they're probably married.
Or it's the not equivalent, ambiguous.
Or the equivalent level of like commitment, and they're going to be together forever. And so on and so forth.
A fairy tale ending, basically.
Yeah, fairy tale ending. Happily for now is especially more of a contemporary thing where it's like, hey, they get together at the end.
Everyone's happy.
Or like, yeah, they are certainly happily for now. There's not necessarily an implication that this was the fated love that will last for all time. But, you know, it's a happy ending.
Well, you kind of assume it is. You don't want to undermine the idea that it could be, but it's also like you might not get that buttoned up epilogue of seeing them, you know, walk their dog in the park wearing matching rings.
Yes.
It doesn't have the finality. And a lot of times happily for now is maybe the first book in a series, the second book in a series. You'll see a lot of happily for now in books that are to be continued. The relationship is to go through its trials and tribulations in a later installment. So if you don't have a happily ever after or something close to it, if you have a tragic or ambiguous ending, you are going to have a hard time publishing and selling that book. If you do manage to publish it, you're going to have a hard time selling it, even if it's very clearly marked as ambiguous, because the expectation of readers is that this is a genre convention. We know when we crack open one of these books that it's going to end happily, and we're not going to throw it across the room because it actually ended in agony, and then we leave very upset reviews.
Yeah. Yes. So I think it's important because that's one of the things actually that romance gets a bad rap for is like, oh, it's so unrealistic. Everything is a happy ending, or like, oh, it just gets buttoned up at the end. But that's actually a really important tool for creating a safe space. And I think it's especially important for queer romance. We have, we've babbled about this on the podcast before for sure, but queer romance or stories with queer characters in them have a legacy of those characters dying
or
being miserable and having very unhappy endings. And part of what queer romance says is that will not happen to you here. A lot of those experiences can be re-traumatizing. They can be upsetting of seeing characters that are like you die or have terrible endings. And so what romance does is create a safe space where if a reader opens your book, they know that you are at least not in those specific ways going to traumatize them or going to upset them. They can know that no matter what happens, they might go through the fire of hell, but at the other end of that is going to be a happy ending. And so that is actually a very, very important genre convention. So some of the other conventions of romance are it's generally going to be either first or third person. Third person is more common. This is not a genre that is particularly warm to experimental forms like second person.
Stream of consciousness.
It's probably going to follow a more traditional narrative arc, a three-act structure.
By three-act structure, we mean there is in, like, the first third of it, and this is rough because it doesn't have to be equal thirds. The first third of it is introducing your characters, their goals. The second third is introducing or amplifying the conflict, the thing that's getting in the way of their goals, and advancing the plot in that way. And then the third is where everything comes to a head, and then after that climax resolves itself. So you've got three beats, three major chunks of the story where it's like establishing, things are getting intense, things peak, and then it ends.
And if that's something you're curious about learning more about, I would look up the three-act structure or the hero's journey. And specifically, there are resources on how that applies to romance. The three-act structure is like the foundation of a lot of literature in all genres, but there are specifically ways that it applies to romance. So definitely look into that if that's something you want to learn more about. It can also be a really helpful roadmap for plotting a book. If you can know kind of what, you know, roughly where various things might need to happen, it can be really helpful for plotting out a whole narrative. Other thing is romance is very commonly told with two points of view, those of the two protagonists, unless it is polyromance or menagen has more than two characters, in which case it'll probably be one point of view for each of them. Sometimes it is told in one point of view, but two is very common, I think, specifically because it allows for you to see both characters or more from multiple lenses. And it allows you to know what is going on in someone's head and how they are perceived outwardly by others, which is something that you, at least if you are me, will notice is challenging to write around sometimes. If you don't have that, if you're writing in a single point of view.
Both of us, as writers, we tend to rest our laurels on one POV, and then we realize, wait a minute, we may have written ourselves into a corner by not being able to hop over here and explain this pertinent information.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot to be said for following the convention there, especially if you are new to writing romance. It's something that is a convention for good reason. It makes it a lot easier to show character from many angles.
It's a lot easier to flesh out your two characters that way, because otherwise you're stuck with one POV, only knowing that other character through the lens of the primary POV.
Yeah. And for example, some of the things that are easier to show with that are if you have, for example, misunderstandings, or maybe a character who comes off very differently to themselves than they do outwardly. There's something that can be very compelling about, for example, you know that a character is actually a sweetheart, but you see how from somebody else's point of view they look like an asshole, and so you're there rooting for the person who thinks they're an asshole to see the real gem inside, and so on and so forth. There's a lot of good reasons to do that.
I read a lot of romances where somebody knew something, they had a secret that they had to keep close to the chest, and it completely impacted the rest of the story. And if that story had been told in one POV, I would have wanted to have punted that character across the room. So sometimes it's the only way you can make a character likable, because it really sucks to plow through, you know, two-thirds of a story not liking someone, and then at the very end they're like, the whole time I was actually not terrible. It's doable. I'm not saying it's not, but when there's such a strong convention of those sorts of situations where a character might not be likable or a character might have a secret that impacts, you know, somebody else, to be able to show that from another POV is so useful.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Also, lengthwise, romance novels are generally around 50,000 words.
That's when they're really seen as a novel.
Yes. That said, there are certainly shorter and longer books. There are series. Erotica tends to be shorter. There are also novellas are also published that could be, you know, 15,000 words and up. Most presses go to print at 40,000 words or higher. It will be ebook only unless it is 40,000 words and up because of the higher overhead. And some things do get published that are shorter, especially in anthology collections or as ebook only. But generally, a romance novel is considered to be 50,000 words. And especially if you do wind up looking up structure stuff. They might refer to like the book length or like how many thousand words you're in or whatever. And that's probably going to be referencing about 50,000 words.
Yeah. And you can absolutely go larger than that. I would caution people against writing an epic as one volume. I know that there are exceptions to this. Everything we're saying has an exception to it, right? Not everything is cut and dry. There are absolutely stories that don't fit the parameters we're talking about that do wonderfully. But most stories, if they're over, honestly, 100, 120K, are not going to sell as well. Readers just... that's a lot of words. That's a lot of story. Your story had better be great if we're going to, one, pay the price point for that, because books of that length are going to be sold at a higher price. And two, invest the amount of time, because not everyone is me and can read 120,000 words in a sitting. And by the way, that's not a useful skill. It's horrible. In my experience as an editor, when something is 120,000 words, it often doesn't need to be. It can be told more concisely and pack more of a punch. And honestly, when you're trying to pack a punch, which romance should be, you should be really paying attention to how your pace is still engaging and how the beats you're hitting are all really strong. If you have 120,000 plus words, it gets kind of meandery. That's not always true. There are some wonderful books that are that long, but in the majority of longer work, over 100, 120K are usually split up, usually multi-volume series. The only time you see really, really long work do especially well as literary fiction, and specifically fantasy. And again, you can absolutely write longer. It's just you might want to brace yourself to be told, like, we're happy to publish this novel, but it's 30,000 words too long. And, you know, if you're looking to write in this genre, pick up a couple books that look interesting to you and see how long they are, and see when you get bored or if you get bored, and see, wait a minute, if my book is this long, will people finish it?
So romance, both traditional romance giants and queer romance, has many, many subgenres. By far the most popular is contemporary romance, which is to say not fantasy, you know, the real world now.
Yeah,
not historical.
Set now.
And contemporary is definitely, I would say, the biggest, highest selling genre, but there are many others. It pretty much queer romance has the same subgenres as traditional.
Yeah.
So westerns.
Historical is not one thing. There's a big difference between a Regency romance and medieval or Victorian or even 1940s.
Big difference between, you know, like epic fantasy and paranormal fantasy.
Urban
fantasy. I bring that up mostly just to say, like, yes, there is queer romance for all of that. You do not have to write contemporary. Like, you can write steampunk queer romance, and I've read that
in space.
Like, it already exists and it's great.
You can write noir, you can write, I mean, honestly, despite the fact that we're rigidly defining what is popular in romance and its history, you can write whatever you want. If you're brand new to this genre, your odds are better if you understand what you're walking into and you can gear your work accordingly.
If you have something that you're really passionate about, I would say go for it. In most cases, because if your passion comes through, that's gonna work better for readers, probably, and it's probably gonna work better for you. At least that's my feeling. You know, if you are really, really drawn to write historical, frickin' write historical. It is good to be aware that not all publishers publish stuff that is not about cisgender men. Many, many, many do, but not all. And we're gonna list off a bunch. And if you, specifically for this one, I want to say, if you are curious about what publisher might be interested in an idea you have, please reach out to us. We know a lot of these presses pretty well and can brainstorm where you might want to send something. I'm mostly thinking of, sometimes it can be hard to tell, like, oh, do they skew towards stories with this kind of vibe?
Mm-hmm.
Or that kind
of
mood?
For sure.
Yeah.
Because each press has its own sort of vibe and reputation, and they might be known in the industry for publishing or marketing a certain kind of romance, and it's like, hey, you should know that.
I can't tell you how many times I've had a friend be like, oh, if I wrote this kind of thing with this mood, would anybody take that? And I'll be like, oh yeah, such and such would love that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not necessarily something you would get from submission guidelines, but,
yeah, or Googling.
But yeah. Who wants this? We're going to have a more complete list in the description, so don't feel the need to strain your wrists scribbling these names down, but an incomplete, very incomplete list of some of the publishers that we brainstormed include Riptide Publishing, Bold Strokes Books, Dream Spinner Press? I think it's Dream Spinner Press.
I'm gonna Google it because I don't know. I think it is Press, yeah.
Yes. And Dream Spinner has a YA imprint called Harmony. Harmony Inc., yes. Riptide has a YA imprint called Triton. Less Than Three Press, Pride Publishing. Bella Books, Nine Star Press, Ilva Press, I think. Love Swept, Karina Press. Karina is an ebook only division of Harlequin. Blind Eye Books, Lucid. So many more. And there are also sort of more romance adjacent publishers that might publish something that would fit as a romance novel that is queer. So there's a lot that are in the romance pool. There are a lot of queer publishers sort of outside that. The ones we've listed are queer romance publishers.
You may have seen books that were queer romance novels published and not realize that that's what they were because their covers weren't ostentatiously romantic. You know, it wasn't two men or two women in a swooning embrace.
Although those certainly do exist.
Those do exist. A lot of beautiful people who are like jaws and torsos. Just like, yeah. Oh, that's a sweet jaw right there.
Yeah. While romance, queer romance specifically, is bigger than you would think, it is also still smaller. And what that means is that there are less hoops to jump through to submit than there might be traditional fiction. You do not need an agent. You can have an agent, but you do not need an agent. Every romance press, queer romance press I've ever seen takes unagented submissions. And most of them are going to have submission guidelines right on their website. You can either just Google the name of the press and submission guidelines, but usually they're fairly easy to find because they're actively acquiring titles.
They want you to write for them.
They want you to write for them. And so if you go and check that out, every single press is going to have a different set of guidelines. They might tell you specifically what they're interested in. I am staring right now at Riptide Publishing's open submission calls page, which specifically mentions, for example, that they are interested in epic high and urban fantasy romance, light and lighthearted romantic comedy, among many other things. And those are going to be great resources. They might also be inspirational because some presses, like for example, Less Than Three Press, runs open collection and anthology calls with specific themes. And you might want to write something specifically for a theme. That's actually how I was first published. I wrote a piece for a May-December age difference romance call at Less Than Three.
Oh, what was it called, Austin?
It was called Silver and Gold.
Who edited it?
It was Amanda Jean.
I don't know who that is. She sounds like a swell gal.
So that's a way that you can get started if that appeals to you. For me, I found it was a low stress way to enter because I didn't have the pressure of supporting a title on my unproven name, especially because I was writing romance for the first time. That was a nice way to kind of dip my toes in.
Yeah, as a hot tip for y'all, if you are nervous about submitting a full-length novel, or maybe you haven't written something that counts as a novel, find an anthology or a novella call and submit for that, because at least with an anthology, you're going to be in there with a bunch of other writers, and some of whom might already have a following, so you might be able to expose yourself to some readers just right off the bat. I think anthologies are a great way to build up your backlist of published works, too, just to have stuff out there in the world.
That's actually leads me into another thing, which is we're talking about publishers right now, but you could also go a self-publishing route. Self-publishing is challenging. It is not the easier route.
It comes with its list of pros
yes,
and cons.
It comes with pros and cons. There are great pros to self-publishing. We actually, we don't have time to go into the specifics, but our previous episode was an interview with Jordan L. Hawk, who is an extremely successful self-published author, and she gave great advice, great like laying out pros and cons of self-publishing and talked about, you know, the overhead you need, all of the stuff that you have to handle if you're self-publishing, and some of the benefits, so... Totally check that out if you're interested in. Just know that it is not easier than going through a publisher.
It is in many ways much harder.
Yes.
But it gives you benefits that going with a traditional publisher wouldn't, i.e. a bigger share of the royalties and total creative control.
Total creative control. But that also comes with you better provide your own cover art. You better do your own editing.
Or hire.
Your own editing services. What you get with a publisher is somebody who is, you know, you should never pay a publisher to publish you. They will pay for cover art. They will pay for a certain amount of marketing, and they will, yeah, you will get professionally edited. They might get you into blog tours, or they might reach out on your behalf to get reviews either on blogs or in various publications, that kind of thing. So you get a lot from working with a publisher. And if you're self-publishing, you got to do all that yourself.
That said, one of the reasons it's so important to Google publishers and to do your thorough research on them is some publishers are better than others in terms of their pipeline. It's sort of like one of those situations where, let's say you find a publisher who they totally fit with the vibe of your book. They seem to be super friendly and professional and you love their backlist, but you hate their covers. Like, you hate them. You have to keep that in mind. Or you'll find somewhere that there's just a lot of authors and you're finding you're competing for space, or you think that their editing could be better. And honestly, that's a situation where it's like, hey, that's a red flag. A lot of people will throw around the term author mill, and that is some place that just churns out publications sort of en masse, and they have constant new releases. And, you know, they might have a lower price point and their editing process is pretty minimal.
And in that case, what they're trying to do is benefit by volume. They're not necessarily invested in the success of individual authors or individual books.
And their standards might be more relaxed than other publishers. But there is no universal standard for what is considered a good book and what isn't. So everything's pretty subjective. That's the thing about publishing, is everything is subjective, right? My favorite book might be your least favorite. An editor might have a different take on something than another editor. I've seen it happen. Two people will work on the same manuscript and disagree over what should happen to it. So it's really just a matter of finding somewhere where you think you'll be comfortable there. A lot of people are published with author mills. Maybe the level of investment you want to put into your work is a great fit for somewhere that focuses on volume. People do make money there and people do gain readership there, but I wouldn't necessarily recommend it. I would say, like, I'm sure that's a fit for somebody, but I don't know that it's a fit for everybody.
And I think, so one of the good ways to narrow down, like, what publisher would work for you is to read widely in the genre, especially if you're not super familiar. Check out, a lot of publishers have a certain amount of, like, free reads, or some authors might have free reads, and
there's a lot of giveaways.
A lot of giveaways, and price points are lower. And plus, a lot of publishers do blog tours where you can check out excerpts of their books. Some have pretty substantial excerpts on their websites, and that's a good way. Like, if you love the books they're making, you probably would enjoy working with them.
Yeah,
that's a really good sign. So yeah, definitely kind of get familiar with the different publishers and check that out. Also, Absolute Right, the Absolute Right forums are a great resource for finding out if publishers are reputable and treat and pay their authors well. So in terms of actually writing your book, we wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, you're going to be working on your book, and there will come a time when you need extra feedback. Everybody needs it. So betas, editors, and sensitivity readers. An editor is going to be someone generally that you pay or that your publisher pays. You might choose to contract an editor before you actually submit to a publisher, or you might not. There are apparently children yelling outside my window, so I apologize if you hear children yelling in the background. But yes, and editors might be, you might employ editors, or your press might employ editors as copy editors, which is to say they'll be looking for line-by-line editing, word choice,
grammar, spelling, typos,
and or they might be content editors who are looking at the big ideas and who are working to kind of shape the story or tell you, you need to develop this character more, your romance comes on too fast, you might need to slow that down, or this is way too long, cut it down, so that kind of thing. It's really important, no matter who you're working with, whether it be an editor or a beta reader or a sensitivity reader, we'll get to sensitivity readers in a minute, that you be prepared for a process of revision and of being able to take criticism. And I say that mostly because I think a lot of new authors are not necessarily super confident in their work, or they feel really good about what they have and they don't want someone to tear it down. And so just please take it from me that nobody should critique to tear something down. It's really, really important, especially as someone new to publishing queer romance, that you be able to adjust course or rewrite based on feedback. And getting criticism is essential for absolutely everybody. Nobody is exempt from that. If you've been publishing for 10 years, you still need an editor. Mostly just because editors and beta readers and sensitivity readers are there to advocate for readers. They're there to say, maybe you, the author, knew exactly what you meant on page 17, but it really wasn't clear for somebody who had just read the words that you wrote, who doesn't have all the backstory that you've invented. So you need to put more of that in.
Or it's a forest for the trees situation.
Yeah. They're there to say, hey, let's step outside of your head. You, the person who wrote this, this is your baby. You know everything about it. Step outside, look at the words you wrote. How can we fine tune that so that your vision comes through and so that the reader gets the best possible experience?
What you intended to write is not necessarily what came across on the page. And maybe what you intended to write isn't the best way to tell a story. You know, there's a better way to resolve this. Maybe there's a more compelling character arc and you just got to dig to find it. And that's what editors and, you know, beta readers are there to help you do. If you go at it with the mindset that this is something precious to you and anyone who criticizes it is criticizing you specifically, that is going to be incredibly painful for you. I really do not want authors to walk into the publishing industry and not be prepared for the fact that it's going to hurt if you have that mindset. It still might hurt. No one wants to be misunderstood, and no one wants their passion project and the fruit of their labor to be disrespected or to perceive it as being disrespected. But the truth is, not everyone's going to understand your story, love your story, or glean what it is you meant to write. And that is something, if you are having trouble grappling with that before having submitted to a publisher, you gotta accustom yourself to it. You gotta get used to that real fast.
Yep, which is another reason why I would highly recommend getting beta readers. Also, I personally cry every time Amanda tells me to change a comma, so.
Something to keep in mind too, for authors who haven't been edited before in a professional context or otherwise, is that tone is really hard to convey over text, right?
Yeah, and I really enjoy being edited. And I think that that's, like, it doesn't necessarily have to be a painful thing. Like, I think, unfortunately, there's sort of a culture of, like, oh, editing, it's the awful part where somebody else comes in and, like, stomps all over your beautiful vision. And for me, I really enjoy getting to have somebody else lavish attention on my prose and, like, try to make it the best it can be. To me, it's one of the great gifts of working with editors is that you have somebody else their undivided attention on making your book absolutely shine.
And so one of the differences between, you know, a beta reader or somebody who is sort of doing you a favor for free and someone who is a professional editor is that 9 times out of 10, the professional editor has a better idea of the industry and like they do this for a living, whereas a beta reader might give you a clearer picture of what, you know, your average audience member might think, which is invaluable. I am not trying to say that that isn't equally important. I think every work should have a beta reader, but your professional editor has a more concentrated focus and their reputation is also connected to yours in mm-hmm. some ways. So they don't want to see you fail. They want to get excited about your stuff and they want you to do wonderfully.
Quick definition of a sensitivity reader. They're different from a beta reader in that a sensitivity reader is specifically employed to help you write outside of your lane, which is to say outside of your personal experience. For example, if you are a cisgender person writing about a trans character, you might employ a trans sensitivity reader, in fact, you probably should, to read through with their lived experience and their knowledge of the community there to make sure that what you are doing is not offensive and harmful. And that's important to do even if you feel like you have a grasp, because a lot of times there's little nuance to small things that totally might just not occur to you that will totally ping a sensitivity reader. I know that I have done sensitivity reads as a trans person that, you know, it might have been just one line that pinged me as like, no one would ever say that.
Or it just, like, doesn't ring as true.
That does not ring as true, or that rings as a little bit, like, not necessarily offensive, but weird, and like, it might raise the hackles of a trans person reading this. Completely innocuous stuff. So sensitivity readers are really important if you're writing outside of your own experience. Some presses will actually employ them for you. So some presses might provide that on their own time.
Part of their editing pipeline, yeah.
Yes. Many, unfortunately, will not. And so if it's something that you're concerned about, and I will say it should be something that you are concerned about, you may want to employ someone on your own time. If you at all have the means, you should pay sensitivity readers.
Yeah, I would actually say if you're going to publish something that isn't your own lived experience or is potentially a minefield, it's something that you realize you could have gotten badly wrong, you should save up and pay a sensitivity reader. Sensitivity readers do important and emotionally taxing work, and they should be paid for their services.
They're oftentimes volunteering, well, not volunteering, but they're reading something that could be triggering for them. It could be re-traumatizing for them. And hopefully they are coming into that, you know, prepared. But at the same time, it's a really important kind of, it's a really important kind of labor. It's not easy work. Also, this is just something that I've seen that I want to throw out there. If your sensitivity reader gives a pass on a book and you publish it, and then somebody is like, I don't like this because of X reason, it's not your sensitivity reader's fault also.
Yeah.
Like, it's just something that you should be prepared to deal with if you're writing outside your lived experiences. You cannot necessarily get it right all of the time, and you gotta just be willing to own that and not, you know, just accept that. Not put the blame on, you know, a sensitivity reader, because again, everybody's lived experience is different. It's not a magic bullet. It will not protect you from all criticism.
Any negative feedback you get, this is very specific negative feedback, right? But any negative feedback you get cannot be protected against by the editing pipeline or by your revision. There's still going to be something someone will find that is bad, that is out of character, that it was poorly done, or that was to them harmful. The time when you need to listen to that above all others is when it is pretty obvious that it was harmful. Like, you can't argue with someone, like, you shouldn't be arguing with viewers anyway. You can't make a case that somebody was not harmed by something. What you can do is say, I screwed this up, I apologize, I will do better in the future. And the bare minimum for making sure that you can stop that in its tracks is by hiring sensitivity readers.
Yep. Before we move on from that, though, people might be wondering, where do you find sensitivity readers and beta readers?
And critique partners.
And critique partners and so on and so forth. So one thing is, if you know romance readers, they are a great resource. If you happen to be friends with a lot of people who read romance novels, they might be willing to do that for you. I'm fortunate that I have a lot of romance reading queer friends, so that has been a resource for me. But if you don't have those immediate connections, and just a note, I say romance readers because people who read romance are going to have a better sense of the beats than people who don't. Romance readers, especially important, but you don't necessarily need always somebody who's a romance reader. However, if you don't have those immediate connections, a couple of those places that we thought of are, again, the Absolute Right forums. Goodreads forums. Those are both places that can help match you with potential beta readers and match other writers who might need betas with you if you are going to do some kind of exchange. You can also join Twitter or Tumblr or Facebook. There are a lot of Facebook groups for writers that do paired critique or workshopping or beta reading. Twitter and Tumblr, you can, there are some communities on Tumblr, for example, that would do that. You can also just put out a post and ask people to signal boost it saying, hey, I'm writing a queer romance, such and such. I'm looking for beta readers, and reach out to the community. If you would like us to signal boost like a request for beta readers, we'd be happy to do that. I think I just said that. We can cut it if we're not, but I think we are.
No,
right?
I think we're fine with it. Yeah.
I can't think of why we wouldn't be. That's an easy way to start dipping your toes into the community as well. And you might also be able to find workshops or critique groups that might be either one-on-one or in a group where you can get some feedback on that. Sensitivity readers also often, you can find them by searching on Twitter or Tumblr. I've seen people get matched with sensitivity readers that way just by saying, hey, I'm writing this book and I need to hire a sensitivity reader. This is what I can pay. This is how long the manuscript is. This is the kind of person I'm looking for.
And as an aside, if you're looking for a beta reader or a sensitivity reader or a crit partner, unless someone is advertised that they're looking to do this, don't ask them directly. basically, what you're looking for is a forum or a conversation where you can sort of add your name to the pile and be like, hey, this is what I'm doing. Or, hey, can someone signal boost this tweet? I'm looking for a sensitivity reader that meets XYZ criteria. And then it gets hopefully passed along. And that's one of the things that Austin and I are willing to do is give you a retweet if you need one. So hit us up at our personal Twitters, which we will list at the end. That is probably the least intrusive way.
Yeah, I think we just mentioned this because most folks, unless you have a personal relationship with them, like I have a number of friends who I am writing partners with and we trade manuscripts back and forth. A lot of folks just don't have the bandwidth to do that unless they're specifically putting it out there that they do. It's a lot of work to read a manuscript and a lot more work to provide critique on it. So a lot of folks are not going to have the bandwidth to do that just off the bat. But if you specifically reach out for beta readers, you're going to get connected to people who do. It's better to just directly go in search of people who are willing to do that than, you know, cold calling someone who may not
know,
probably doesn't have time. It's important to not just think of this as a business or as just books, because it is about books, but you might be surprised at how big the community is and how much, you know, we all just kind of hang out and talk to each other and talk about our books and swap tips
and make friends.
I have made so many wonderful friends, and it's been really important to me and might be particularly important to other marginalized authors in this genre, like being able to reach out to a group of trans authors, for example, has been super, super important for me. Being able to talk to them about how we handle, you know, writing non-universal trans experiences, or how we handle depicting stuff that's relevant to trans folks in our books, the stories that we're writing and the characters we're working on. And you can find that if you reach out. And most folks are happy to make connections and talk and you know, just dive in and like see what's getting published and see what people are gabbing about. It's a really neat space. And I want more people to know that it exists and come hang out with us.
There's conventions for this industry.
Yes.
There's conferences for this industry. We talk all the time about the Gay Romance Northwest conference because that's essentially where we met and where everything we do comes from in many respects. But there's so many others. There's Rainbow Con.
There's also the Gay Romlet or retreat or GRL.
Yeah, there's so many, and we can provide links to that if need be. But one of the things, this is a little bit of an aside, but at the second, I think, GRNW, a lot of us will sort of congregate and go out and have a good time before and after, like the night before or the night of. And one of the times I dragged along two people who have never had anything to do with queer publishing, they probably never read queer romance in their lives. So I took them with me to hang out with a group of us at a bar, and they were so delighted because the amount of fun and the amount of just community that we had in an hour, and just generally speaking, the people that you will meet are very kind and fun. Oh my God, the irreverence and the glory and the filth. There's a lot of filth. They were like, this is your job? And I'm like, well, not every day's like this, but yes, this is my job. And that's what's so interesting when you get to creative industries, and essentially queer publishing is hopefully a mashup of a hobby and a job, passion and a job, that it makes it unique. It gives it its own set of challenges, but also its own set of rewards. If you are queer and you read and write queer romance, you probably understand that need for community better than most. So another thing to keep in mind is the fact that because it's a community, it's diverse. And there are going to be all sorts of people in it, which is one of the best things about it, because it has opened my eyes to things I was not aware of. The representation of disability and trans people and people of color, stuff that I thought I was pretty woke to, but really wasn't. The things that you're like, oh, I am a forward-thinking person. Surely no, you have no idea. Go and friend some people and listen. There's going to be differences across the board in terms of what people think of the genre, how much time they spend writing. It's just a really diverse melting pot of people and experiences. And keep that in mind, because that can lead to good and to bad.
And if you come in with an open mind and you're prepared to share a writing space with a really awesome group of people, I think generally you'll do fine. Yeah, just be aware that this is a way bigger space than people think it is. Way more profitable, way more diverse, way more noisy and fun. And yeah, it's a pretty neat space, and I hope that you will join us here.
Come.
Cackles and rubs my hands together.
We have candy. I don't have candy, but I'll get candy. If you come to
it's almost Halloween.
It's almost Halloween. It will probably be, actually, it might not be Halloween when
this
we post
this. This
better
go up before Halloween.
I know. Like,
I'm just going to place that right in the recording.
I know, that's not getting edited out. So essentially, we are, we hope, extremely friendly, fun people. And the people that we interact with are friendly and fun and talented and smart. And they teach us stuff every single day. I learn things every single day. Austin doesn't learn anything because he knows everything. But ostensibly, Austin could learn things every single day.
Ostensibly.
Oh no.
I think we should stop the recording.
Oh God. We're gonna end it on the end.
Yeah. Wah, wah, ostensibly. Wah. The end. Stop. That's it. Go home.
Part two coming up. Yeah. It's,
yes. So do you join us for part two, where we will be talking about submitting manuscripts, working with editors, marketing, blah, da, da,
covers,
lots of other stuff.
All the fiddly stuff.
Yes,
and
contracts and so on and so forth. And as always, if you would like to keep up the conversation, you can find us on Twitter. I am at Austin Chanted.
I am at Amanda H. Jean.
And that is our show. Thank you so much.
This episode of The Hopeless Romantic was produced by Dario DeFore, with graphics by Keezy Young and music composed by Carly Ann Warden. Follow us on Twitter at TheHRPodcast, add us on Facebook, and please rate and review on iTunes if you enjoyed.